Today is December 18th, 2002. This is Donna Ziegenhorn, and I am talking this morning with Joe Bader. Joe, thanks for coming.
Are you related to Dr. Ziegenhorn?
Dr. Dallas Ziegenhorn?
I think her name is Camille Ziegenhorn.
Oh, Camille. Yeah? Well, I'm related through marriage. She is...
Oh, she's married to... Yeah, that is...
My husband's name is Ziegenhorn, and Camille is married to one of my husband's cousins.
He's a dentist, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. 75th and all.
Well, she was my doctor for a number of years.
Oh, was she?
But no, she started having children. And she's only part-time, and I couldn't see her that well, so I shifted to another.
Yeah. Are you still in the same practice?
I beg your pardon?
Is your doctor still in the same practice she's in?
Oh, yeah, primary physician.
We go to that practice, too.
Oh no, I'm sorry. The word practice sent me off. No, I went from Shawnee Mission down to Menorah.
Oh, okay.
My new doctor's down in Menorah.
Okay. Well, Joe, let's get into this interview.
Okay.
Tell me, are you from Kansas City?
No. I was born in Philadelphia and was raised for the most part in New Jersey.
You were?
North Jersey, yeah, near New York.
Did you grow up there in Jersey?
Pretty much, yeah. There was a brief stint during the Depression years. In 1933, we moved from New Jersey back to Philadelphia. I had spent my first couple of years in Philadelphia. We moved back there. It was in the midst of the Depression. And my father was renting in New Jersey. We were moving constantly to get cheaper rents because the economy kept getting worse. Mm-hmm. And it hit bottom about 33, and he was down to 4 days a week with company. At that time, my mother's father, my grandfather's second wife died, Nettie, she died. He was alone down in East Falls, Philadelphia with a house. He had a house, one of those row houses, which it's interestingly, you didn't amortize your mortgages then. You bought the house and you paid the interest on the loan, and that was rent.
Uh-huh. I mean,
so he had the house, and he needed someone to take care of him because he was getting up near to 60. And so we all moved down there. We lived rent-free, but my mother was there to take care of him, and my father commuted to Kearny, New Jersey from Philadelphia. It was about 65 miles. Hmm. He commuted on weekends. He would stay in New Jersey with his sister and her family, and then on Friday he would come home.
Or,
what's that?
Was it take the train?
No, it was a carpool. There were about four other.
Uh-huh.
The Western started in Philadelphia. That's where he started working for them. A lot of men were... They were all transferred to Kearny, New Jersey when the place moved there in 1929.
Mm-hmm.
But many of these guys never moved. They commuted from Philadelphia.
So about how old were you when that was going?
Well, I was nine when we went to Philadelphia.
What are your memories of being a child during the Depression?
You know, I was young enough that I never knew I was in a Depression. But I knew my father was worried.
Mm-hmm.
He had a great ability to maintain a sense of humor during the 30s. He was a very proud man in certain respects. He never showed off to his children that he was sad or sick or anything like that. But I could put pieces together even at that age. He was working at Kearny all week on his regular job, but then he'd come down to be with us on weekends, but even then he worked Friday night and Saturday night for his brother-in-law who owned a saloon in Philadelphia. And my father, who always liked to sing and so on, but he put on skits and shows at the bar Friday night and Saturday night to bring a crowd in. And then he would often tend bar on Sunday afternoon, and he'd get all that for $2.50.
Wow.
Did all that.
Uh-huh.
I overheard him talking one day to my mother about trying to sell his watch on the street corner in Philadelphia. You know, it was humiliating for him, but they were very tight, very tight. But I really never really knew it, because everybody was
in the same situation.
And we were homeowners. Actually, we were middle class. With all of that, we were still middle class. We weren't really the poverty.
Right. Were you? Did you have brothers and sisters?
I had an older brother, 2 years older than I.
Uh-huh.
It was very important to my life. I hung out with him all growing up, you know.
Do you have a story about how he was important to you?
I think so. It was a funny situation. I was the bright one in school. Mm-hmm. Not that he wasn't bright, he didn't care then. And so I got favored a lot by my father because he never had passed in the eighth grade, but like many people who never get past the eighth grade, they have an enormous appreciation of higher education because they don't have it. You know, that kind of. And so I was getting favored, and this, in a way, I can remember it was a plus and minus for my brother because, in one sense, the heat was off him. He didn't have to perform. In fact, they accepted his bad grades. You know, he got a free ride on that. On the other hand, it hurt him to see all the attention going somewhere else because he was the oldest, and the oldest child has a particular responsibility to the family. So he was very protective of me. But he was also a dictator, you know, he would always lead the group we were with. He always was the one that everyone gravitated to, which was opposite from in the family. And so I would go through these periods of jealousy and anger. But he's the one who initiated me into manhood.
How so?
This is gross. It's really gross. He hung out with a guy named Billy Cook, and Billy Cook was an oversexed teenager. Uh-huh. And my brother went through the first year or two of puberty with Billy Cook, and my brother was obsessed with women and with the sexual organs and so on. And so one night, he had Billy Cook, and I was out there with him. He let me hang around with Billy Cook, and my brother was always telling me about how big Billy Cook's penis was. And so there were three or four of us, a couple of kids my age, my brother and Billy Cook, and Billy Cook was going to take a leak. And they said, "You got to watch this," you know. And we all come around to look at Billy Cook's penis. And as he was peeing, he saw me really staring, and he flipped it up and he peed on me.
Oh!
I was chagrined, my brother laughed, uh-huh. You know, and it was a lesson, uh-huh. You know, it was a streetwise lesson, you know. You always have to be careful on the street, uh-huh. Always, you know, as a way. And he had that talent that my father had of sizing up the environment, the street, to see what's real and what isn't. And I always had this naive look at world. I believed everybody, no matter what they said, you know. And maybe that's a role we settled on. I was out with him all the time, so I could afford to do that because he'd keep me from being burned too bad.
Yeah.
You know,
he had the street smarts.
Yeah, and we kind of came to this strange equilibrium, the two of us, mutual needs. I kept the family's eye off him, and he protected me on the street all the time.
Yeah,
and I never realized until years later that was what was happening.
Uh-huh.
You know, but going through puberty was very difficult in those days. But in my house, my mother was extraordinarily prudish. In fact, I've thought about it in the years, the last 10 or 15, 20 years since she's died. What the hell happened? She was an only child. And according to my mother, her mother was extremely prudish. My mother told me that when she got pregnant with my brother, they lived across the street from where she was raised. She went over to ask her mother how the baby was going to come out.
Really?
This is what my mother told me.
Wow.
And her mother said the same way it went in is what she told her. Uh-huh. That's total sex education my mother had. You know, and I don't, that was hard for me to believe, but that's what she told me, and the way I believe it.
Yeah.
And my mother was also, I didn't realize, very seductive with me. She specialized in me too. And she told me things she never even told anybody else. Personal, intimate things about herself.
About her sex life?
Not about sex directly, because if you mentioned sex to her, she became very agitated, and yeah. You could get really hit. I mean, she would have reacted violently to sexual especially when we're kids. But she would also, a lot of this I went over with a psychiatrist I went with for 7 or 8 years. But,
yeah, yeah.
You know, but she was very seductive. I mean, even when I was in my 20s, she would tell me about her sexual intercourse with my father, which was, even when she told me, I felt a little bit off the mark. Uh-huh. But what she was telling me was that sex was for her, was just a chore, that she never got any pleasure out of it. Never. Mm-hmm. You know. And so it was always a mystery to me, because I remember my brother talking and thinking that back in Philadelphia, in those days, that she was having an affair with a guy who owned a diner.
Your brother told you this?
Yeah.
Huh.
Years later.
And this was, do you know, a long-term affair?
It apparently didn't last very long. I remember her one time taking me to a diner, and I met this guy. I still have a faint picture of the guy. He had slick black hair, you know, and a sort of mustache. And kind of a smaller guy, but he gave me the key. He let me play in his car outside, which was great for a kid because nobody had cars. And I was out there for a good half hour, 45 uh-huh. minutes, before my mother came back out again. And I saw nothing of it, but after my brother told me years later, I figured that's mother was having an affair.
Uh-huh.
She was going to bed with him, and I was out in the car keeping myself busy.
Do you think that this is something that your brother, it just picked up on through his street smarts?
Yeah.
Or do you think he knew it?
No, I think he's just, I tended to put some credence because he was pretty good.
Uh-huh, yeah.
He was pretty good.
Uh-huh.
But it was just and so sex was the more they suppressed it, the more I wanted to know about it. It became a big deal for my brother and me.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, my brother for the rest of his life became a real, almost addicted to it, one woman after another. Even after he got married, I mean, it was just, it had a lot, his self-esteem was involved in it and all that, and mm-hmm. you know, and it became fixation. And with me, it became a source of great shame growing up, because there was a lot of talk in our house about sex. We had an adopted, a girl, When one of our places we lived in New Jersey before getting to Philadelphia was a place called Maplewood, Northern Jersey. And in 1931, we lived in Maplewood, and up the street was the family called Linzer, the Linzers. It was Ed and his wife Ann Linzer. They had a son called Junior. He looked just like a junior too. He was fat and he was, you know, weak.
And,
and then there were two girls living there they were the official guardians for these two girls, their sisters, Rose and Elvina. Rose was 2 years older than Elvina. Elvina at that time was 11 or 12 years old. And I don't know how she made first contact with my mother. Maybe because Dad and Ed Linzer got to be friendly. I don't know. But she started hanging around our house all the time, Elvina. More and more and more. And the Linders didn't care because it was one less mouth to feed if she was. They didn't give a damn. So I never knew all the intricacies of it. But when we moved from Maplewood, she came with us. And she ended up going to Lyndhurst with us. My father raised her from time 11 or 12 years old. No adoption. The Linders didn't care. And then I remember in Philadelphia, Elvina was in the very height of puberty. She had been, I learned later, abused by Junior and the Linzers. They used to make her or her sister sleep with Junior on alternate nights, you know, in that house. But I never knew any of that at the time. That all came in later. Elvina told me that when I was about 30, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, she had, she was neurotically from it all. I mean, and she needed love deeply. And so she was susceptible to any guy on the streets when she was 15 or 16 years old. And so in East Falls, Philadelphia, where we live, she got pregnant.
And at the age of?
15, 16 years old. She got pregnant, and this introduced the subject, which I talk about, and people really can't believe, of abortion during the 30s. Abortion was very important to everybody And although it was against the law and a sin, nobody really made any noise about it in those days. Well, anyway, there was a guy in Philadelphia that all the women, I used to hear them talk about it now, used to refer to as the barber. And women would get pregnant, and they'd hear the other women saying, well, have you called the barber yet? Or the woman would say, my husband called today and said, damn it, have you called the barber yet? Mm-hmm. And I found out years later, when I was about 15 or 16, that the barber injected something called ergot, into the uterus, and it induced an abortion. It induced a miscarriage. And so the Alvina had one of those first. And then she got pregnant again. And she kept it secret too long, and she couldn't get an abortion, so she gave birth to an illegitimate child. And they kept it from me, and my brother and I didn't even know she had a baby.
You didn't know she was pregnant?
Didn't know she was pregnant, because she went away. She went to this Catholic home for girls who were pregnant. She had the baby there, and the baby stayed at the home. And then she came back, and we never knew, my brother and I. And it wasn't until much later that we realized. Because when this little girl joined us about 5 years later,
she joined you, the child.
Joined us. The little Dora. She lived with us for a while until my Alvina got married, and then she's still alive today, Doris. Huh. You know, but then after Alvina, apparently, I learned later my mother had one too. Had one of those therapeutic abortions.
Oh, she did.
Yeah, the ergot. And that leads. So sex was there. It was heavy. You could smell it and feel it, but you couldn't talk about it.
Yeah.
Couldn't talk about it. And I was entering puberty. I was then 11, going into 12. And at that period, I became frightened. I don't know why. I've talked to psychiatrists about it. And they say it happens to a certain percentage of boys entering puberty. It's just a generalized dread. Uh-huh. You know, fear. I lived with it all my life ever since. Fear. Just plain fear. Fear of everybody. Fear of, if anybody looks angrily at you, you go into a fear response, you know. And it went through me all through life. In fact, it governed the development of my personality from...
Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Did working with a psychiatrist help you with that?
They helped quite a bit, but what helped most was, which is where the stories really are, was when I got sober in 1975.
Oh, tell me about that.
Yeah. Well, I was alcoholic for years. I didn't like drinking in the beginning, but then when I got out of the Army in 1946, I really took it up in earnest. And I didn't realize I had the disease, but I did, and I learned later that throughout my family, too. My father turned out.
Your father did?
Yeah, he was a late bloomer, but he became one, and my grandfather lived with us. He was an alcoholic. My brother died of alcoholism.
Wow, so it's really genetic
threat. Yeah, we had a genetic, but but anyway, I was an alcoholic maybe 25 years. And then I finally got to the bottom. And
what did the bottom look like for you?
Well, I had walked out on my wife and children. The boys were teenagers and grown, but my daughter was only 9 years old, and in 1969, I just walked out. I wanted to remove all the final constraints that there were. And I met another woman, and she was alcoholic, and we got married, and we just took ourselves to the bottom. The worst, if you look at the worst elements, and that's about a year before I got sober, my second son, who was studying psychology at college, came visit us, and we had a woman over for dinner, a friend of my wife's, and she was bisexual and crazy in her sexual things. My wife and I are involved in all kinds of stuff. The low point that night was I was smoking pot and drinking, and so were they, and then somebody suggested a threesome or an orgy. I'd never done that before. And I went in and invited my son to join in, and he was just absolutely floored. I mean, I still can't, sober looking back on it, and say, what the hell was going through my mind? We never did have that orgy, but the point was that he got up in the morning about 5 o'clock and left, went back to California. And that was probably the low point. That was the low point.
Is that what brought you to wake up that you had to do something about this?
Yeah, a few months later, I was meeting my wife at the Port of Authority bus terminal in New York where we worked at the time, as I did every night. And I'd been on a bender. A bender is an extended drinking period. It lasts 3 or 4 or 5 days. It doesn't last longer because the human body can't take that much alcohol constantly. But what it was for me and a lot of others I know is the need. It's almost infantile. You have a need to drink about every 2 hours. You have to keep it going. The high becomes so just painful, and to relieve the pain, you have to keep doing it. The pain gets worse, you got to keep doing it. And it's so thoroughly humiliating because you have to carry a bottle with you at all time. And I went to work in the AT&T building at 195 Brooklyn.
In New York you're talking about, or where?
Yeah, New York. And I was the director. I had a fifth level manager. I had a lot of promotions over the years. And here I am. I run out of booze. So the first thing I had to do was somehow get to the men's room and get rid of the empty. Uh-huh. That may seem trivial to you, but to the alcoholic, it's critical. And so I'd go in there, and I had to make sure nobody's in there. Mm-hmm. Then I'd take this empty pint, and I'd push it all the way down to the bottom of the trash can. Uh-huh. See? And then I'd have to get another pint. Uh-huh. These were major decisions that had to be made. And I would go out of the building, and I'd go to these liquor stores, and in the financial district, they see so much alcoholism in the liquor stores that they even pack it a certain way so it looks like a flat package.
Oh, yeah.
See, and then I put it in my leather case, and I go back into the building, and then I start to sweat because they had guards, and you were not allowed to bring liquor into the job. The guards made random tests, and I'd walk forward. My heart would be pounding, my head pounding. Would they stop me and look at my leather case? And then you'd hold your breath and you'd smile and try to get the guy in a conversation and walk by, and then he didn't go in and look, and you'd be this enormous sigh of relief. All of this energy, all of this effort and attention into this simple addiction. And finally it got to the point, about that time, it was on this bender, and I was waiting to meet my wife, and she came, and I was full of panic, just pure panic, and I said to her, Dory, let's go into the restaurant and eat. I just had to talk to her. And we sat down, and I ordered a martini, like I always did, and I had taken a sip of it, and I suddenly turned to her, and I said, Dory, I said, I can't do it anymore. It was this complete, I can't do it anymore. And it was all live well, stop drinking, I can't. And she really met the moment. She said, Joe, that's okay, we'll start tonight, and I'll stay with you all night. I'm not going to leave your side. I'll get you through this night, and then tomorrow we'll get help, you know. And then she said, so you don't have to announce the whole restaurant. And they were all looking, because I said it at almost the top of my lungs. Oh, I can't stop. Uh-huh. It was like a yell, you know, primeval scream. I didn't know what else to do. So this can convince you how alcoholism is, how serious it is. After I had that experience, I achieved it. I then finished my drink. I think I finished the drink. Anyway. The next day, I detoxed myself. I'd been in detox a number of times, and they detox you with the tranquilizers. You know, each day they withdraw more and more, so you wean you off. Mm-hmm. So I did the same thing, and I had
this by yourself?
Yeah.
Okay.
I took 24 Valium tablets the next day, four every 4 hours, and it hardly worked. They hardly had much effect by that time. My tolerance was so high. And I went to my office, but my secretary, who I'd made deep friends with and made very dependent on me, mm-hmm. protected me all day. She wouldn't let anybody in. Anything to be signed, she would sign my name to it, mm-hmm. because I couldn't write. That's her name.
She knew what was going on.
Oh, yeah. She didn't really know I was alcoholic. She didn't understand the disease. Yeah. But anyway, I called medical that day, and I told her, this doctor friend of mine, I said, I really need help. I'm really in trouble. And that's the only thing I had to do before anything. Everything got in motion. Machinery got in motion at the company. Next thing I know, the guy was over the house, and he was suggesting I go to this place up in North Jersey near there, way out in the woods, one of the oldest and largest rehab centers in the country. And I was in that final surrender, that final, you know, it's almost like a high. I don't have to worry about it anymore because I'm in somebody else's hands and, you know.
The resources are working for me, yeah.
And I did not do a thing. Everything just kept coming. And he finally set up. I was going to be up there for at least 12 weeks. A long time, intern. And somebody said, what about the company? I said, well, I can't help that now. I got more important problems. That's the way it was. So I went. And that was the second great thing that happened. Now I look back on it, it was all a matter of some kind of grace that was happening, because I wasn't looking for it, but it kept happening to me. You know, anyway, the woman who ran the place was a pioneer in AA and a remarkable, brilliant woman in her own way. She was about close to 80 when I went up there. But she had she was a very bright person who had worked with probably 10,000 alcoholics over her lifetime. And she couldn't be fooled. No way. Mm-hmm. She'd been lied to by the best, you know. Very strict, very hard. And she just took me away from everything. You couldn't have, your family couldn't visit you for 3 weeks. You could make no telephone calls. You could write letters. That was it. They took your money, your keys, everything else. And you're way out here in North Jersey where there's nothing. And if you walk off on your own, the state police pick you up and bring you back anyway. Mm-hmm. It's that place. Mm-hmm. And she believes that they keep the routine for you steady. One day is like the next day. I never understood that, because I thought, how boring it all is, you know. You could only read two books. They're both AA books. You couldn't have magazines. You couldn't have any diversionary things at all. What she was doing was keeping the background constant against which you change. You wouldn't recognize your change if everything else was changing around you. There's too much noise. So she kept, everything was the same for you from day to day to day to day. So as your attitude changed, you knew it was you. Mm-hmm. It was you, nothing else. It's a simple idea, but it was fundamental. Uh-huh. And she also dealt with utter honesty. Utter, complete. You ever face total honesty? It's awesome, and it's daunting and fearful. Mm-hmm. You know, she, when I left, and I worked hard up there, and she kept me an extra week. I was there 13 weeks. When I left, she looked across, and she could look at you with steel and have a very soft voice behind it. It was amazing what she could do. I've got to get all filled up here, right? She looked across the desk, and she said, Joe, in the kindest voice, but very direct, she said, I give you a 50-50 chance of making it. She said, it's going to be hard. You can do it. 50-50. And I walked out, and I had the mixed feeling. On one hand, you know, I wanted to do it. On the other hand, why didn't she butter me up a little? You know, give you a good chance.
Yeah.
That's not what she does. And it worked, because I came out and I needed that goad, that idea. It was serious shit I'm involved with here in my life.
Yeah.
And I virtually lived in Alcoholics Anonymous for the next 10 years. I went to meetings every day. I went back to that lodge over the next 2 years, five times, each time a week, each time, on refreshers for 2 years. I lived at the lodge on weekends. Virtually my wife and I were up there Saturday night and all day Sunday, week after week after week. And that's how I got sober. But it was also how my second life began. At that point of total despair is something so awful that it's hard to describe. At the same time, I'm convinced now that that's how redemption is experienced. And somehow you have to, I had my ego destroyed and rebuilt. It was a reorganization of myself from that point on. So I can't even, to this day, this is my life, this 28 years, this other part of my life. It's just pushing into the dimness of, I tried going to a reunion of my high school class, and I felt completely out of place.
You were so different.
I was so different.
Yeah.
It's like everything, and everybody was a stranger to me. But I learned through the years of that thing what redemption is, and with redemption, what real grace is. And it really has nothing to do with religion. It doesn't have to do with religion at all. It has to do with experience and a breakdown in the basic denial that we carry with us. Mm-hmm. Denial not against what we see outside, but denial of what we are ourselves. And all my life, up until that point, I knew I had defects of character, but they all seemed, I've always thought of them as not really me. You know, that's not the way I really am. They're temporary, imminent things, and they just happen to be there at that instant, but that's not me. That's the denial. Mm-hmm. That's basically what it is. And getting into AA taught me to break that down. That's the hard part. That is me.
To have that kind of honesty you were talking about.
Yeah. It is me. That's step one. It doesn't happen. Some people it happens quickly. Others it happens over a period of years. And that's what happened to me over a period of years. I realized that all the things that I hated about myself were me. Mm-hmm. They weren't things. They weren't warts. They were me. They were part of me. Part of me in the same way that gentleness is part of me, in the same way that being tall is part of me. Uh-huh. I had to internalize all that. And it was frightening because I said, if that's me, how am I ever going to, grow and come? But then I learned that's the only way you can grow. Mm-hmm. It's from a self-knowledge of who you are and what you are. And then being an AA, you see, you can do this because everyone's doing it. And meetings are places where you talk about your attempts to do this and your failures, and everybody laughs like hell. It's all done against this background of empathy and humor and closeness,
yeah,
and a sense of clutching and clinging to each other.
Yeah.
At the same time, being brutally honest with each other. And when you do that, when you're able to go across that gulf and see your person and accept it with some kind of positive sense that that's the way it's supposed to be right now. That's, this is me, but it's okay. It's all right, you know. And when you do that, the next step is crucial. That is the awareness that life has always been too much for you. That you're not in control of life and fate, that you're really much more like a reed in the wind. You know, it isn't that you don't have responsibilities and need, you do. You have to do what you can do. But the results of life are beyond you, and always will be. Mm-hmm. Always will be. And that's the real breakthrough. That idea, that's the key to humility, and that's the secret.
That you're not in control.
You're not in control. Furthermore, you're not supposed to be in control. And it's all right if you're not in control. As long as you do what you're supposed to do. You know, when I left, she knew I was an agnostic atheist because I made that clear when I was up there. I grew up Catholic. And I had enough Catholic shit shoved down my throat that I didn't want any more of it, you know. And so she said, Joe, look, she said, when you go out, I want you to go to churches. I want you to find out what you can about this God you don't believe in. you know, because you go to churches, you'll be talking to people who know more about it than you do. And you owe it to yourself to basically do the research. So we did. My wife and I went to the Dutch Reformed Church, United Church, Presbyterian Church, the Methodist Church, you know. And finally we found our way into the Unitarian Church.
Yeah, can I ask you a couple of questions? You're still in New York at this time.
What's that?
Are you still living in New York at that time?
Yeah, well, we started, yeah. Well, we're living in New Jersey, right across the river. Yeah.
And your wife, Dory?
Dory, yeah.
She's
from Kansas City, yeah. No,
did she sober up the same time you did?
Well, a year after I did. She wasn't as far gone as I was, not anywhere near it, but she was on a road. She was getting blackouts. But she got on sober after I did. And she became active in both Al-Anon and AA. Anyway, so while we were there in Jersey, we went to the Dutch Reformed Church for a while. Then we went to the United Church of Christ, the small church in the town we grew up. And then we moved to, and we had a wonderful, you talk about grace. Dory and I got married, and we got together in 69, we got married in 71. And I was convinced that maybe because of my drinking or whatever, we couldn't have any children. But we tried, we never tried to not have children, and nothing. And married in 71, I got sober in 75, and then I retired in 78. Because I couldn't give the job what it really needed. It needed 24/7, and I can't do that. So I made my thing and I retired and got my pension. And I wanted to work with drunks anyway. Anyway, the point of this was in 78, when I decided to retire early in 78, I went home to tell my wife of my decision. And I got home first and I'm waiting for her and all keyed up. Oh, I'm going to retire, Dory, in 3 or 4 months. And then she came in and she looked at me and she said, the baby died. I mean, the rabbit died. The rabbit died. And I was stunned. And for a minute, I said, well, I didn't know the rabbit was even sick. And she said, I'm going to have a baby. The very night I went home to tell her I was going to retire.
Gosh. Now, and how old were you then?
78, I was 54.
54.
54.
And so she had a baby.
She had a baby.
And that baby is now?
That baby is now 24. And I raised her. She had the baby. It was born in January 79. And then Dory stayed home for 3 or 4 months, then went back to work. And then we had a woman, wonderful woman, come in with Carrie. But when Carrie got to be two, I didn't want to be away from her. See, my first kids, I had missed seeing them grow up, you know, and but with Carrie, I could not. I had the means, so I quit counseling, I quit everything. I came home and stayed home all day, and I raised Carrie, and Dory worked. And I think of besides AA, that's probably the most emotionally and spiritually satisfying thing I ever did.
Was raise Carrie.
Yeah, going into that, being what it was like to be a father at home or mother, what I never understood about my wife, you know.
Yeah.
With the first one.
Like you had this whole chance to do it over again.
Oh, yeah, complete. It's just complete grace. I wasn't looking for that. It was never a goal of mine. It just was handed to me after I got sober. Just handed to me. It was there. I can't explain it any other way. And I learned, I mean, being home at my age, everything was new. You know, everything seemed to be a gift coming in because I didn't know what I wanted in the first place. I mean, I was just doing. And I found out what it's like to be with a 2 or 3 or 4 year old brain all day long. Mm-hmm. You know, and I find myself when my wife would come in at night, I couldn't wait till she got home. And I'd say, tell me about your job. Tell me about real problems at UPS.
Yeah.
And
adult conversation.
Yeah, adult conversation. Uh-huh. And she was anxious to get past that because she had that all day.
Mm-hmm.
She got past that. She wanted to get with the baby, you know, and do baby talk.
Like. Right.
So we finally set aside the time at dinner when we would talk adult, you know, otherwise the child would dominate the life. And it worked. It worked beautifully. And in some way, she became even a better mother because and the baby benefited enormously. Dory would put that baby to bed at night and spend 40 minutes singing, reading, talking.
Yeah.
The child, and it helped the child. Her verbal skills are amazing, you know. But anyway, it was just a remarkable experience. And then Dory, my parents, died. They were all dead before we got married. But Dory was getting the point where she wasn't going to go much further with the company, and her family was all out in Kansas City. She's 17 years younger than I am. So she had a chance to transfer out to Kansas City, and I said, let's do it. Because I wanted Carrie to grow up with her grandparents and uncles and everything else. And so when Carrie was 4, we moved out to Kansas City.
Uh-huh.
And Carrie went through the whole system here, and her grandmother's over in Lee Summit, and she spent much, much time with her, all that. So it turned out to be a great move. And then I've been out here ever since.
Uh-huh.
And it's just been, I had a heart attack and 2 years after I got out here. I had had heart attacks before, but this one, I drove myself to the hospital. And by the time I got to the hospital, it was a raging heart attack. And I walked in the hospital and I forget this woman's maid or a doctor or something was standing there. And I walked in and I said, I'm having a heart attack. You know, and she said, come on. I said, I'm really having a bad heart attack. So they rushed me onto a gurney, and it was a nightmare. You know, you're in this open room with these lights, bright lights, and it's all you can see, and there's faces coming over, and things are hectic, you know, when you're laying there. And the woman from the business office is standing there. She's trying to get insurance information out of you. And this cardiologist is trying to stabilize your condition. And the last thing I remember is this business office woman saying, do you have company insurance? That's the last thing I meant. And then I literally died. My heart stopped. And then I had the experience, which to me is almost pure grace, which I insist no one ever try to explain for my benefit. I had one of those near-death experiences.
What happened? What do you remember about that?
There's no word in the language to describe what it would be like to be without your body. We never developed a language for that. Mm-hmm. When you think about it, it's not light. it's just being without the body. It's being almost feathery. It's being wispy. Mm-hmm. It's total freedom is the only way that you can describe it, because there's no sense of the body at all. There's no body. I can't describe what it's like to be without a body, but you're free of it. And the other thing is that this is an enormously deep sense of peacefulness. A deep, quiet peacefulness. And no sense of time at all. It could have been a million years, or it could have been a microsecond.
Mm-hmm.
But it was this feeling, you know, that. And I don't know how long it lasted, but then it brought me back, and I could smell the burning, you know, from where they used the paddles. It's a certain fleshy, burnt flesh smell. Come in, and then you come in, all this noise and these lights and people throwing things, you know, and your wife. My wife was there staring at me like, my God, are you going to live? And I came out of it bubbling with enthusiasm, bubbling with the word, bubbling about what I discovered. And it was like discovering gold.
Yeah.
You know?
How has that changed your, has that experience influenced your life since then?
Fundamentally. It took away, remember that fear I told you about when I got when I was 12? It was gone that night. It's gone. That fear's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And I did something smart for change. You know, I'm in AA and I work on my ego, but you never really get rid of your ego. I mean, you've always got to contend with it.
You've got to have it, certainly.
You know, and I love to impress people, and I always did, and I know I do, and so on. And so my temptation on that initially was to tell everybody, you know, I was now the prophet. See, oh man, you don't understand. You got it all wrong, you know. And I told my wife, and I told her the good news. I said, God, this story, this is for everybody. This is what dying is. Think of it. I can think of it. And I was telling the doctors and the nurses, and they were rushing me to get me ready for bypass surgery because I went out again. They couldn't stabilize it. And every time I came to, I was grabbing anybody, you know.
Telling them the news.
The great news, you know. But then after the operation and I got out, I had an experience and I learned from it. One of you. My wife's nephew was a doctor. He'd just gotten through medical school. And I told him about it and he said, these are my words. Oh, Joe, he said, oh, that's nothing more than, he started out, when the brain is denied oxygen, then it can't process all the sensory information from your body, and consequently, the awareness of your body disappears because the brain can't handle, even though the brain is still alive for a certain amount of time, it can't process anything, and that's really what you saw. And it was about that time. Leslie Farber is a doctor, a psychiatrist, whose specialty is the human will. Mm-hmm. And I read him, and I was deeply moved by him. But what he said, in essence, was that two things. He said that the main cause of human anxiety is attempting to will that which cannot be willed. And remember, he had you do a little exercise in that chapter. You write down on one column here what you want, what's important to you, what do you want out of life, you know. And I had good health, and I had success on a job, and a happy marriage, and drug-free, healthy children, and, you know, a whole list of things. Then he said, put on the right what you can will, whether these can be willed by you or not, or what you can will. Regarding these. And it's very stark when you do that. None of the things you want out of life can you will directly. None of them. Mm-hmm. You think about it, if you ever give it a moment's thought.
Yeah.
Success on a job depends on a lot of things outside yourself and other people. Yeah. Happy marriage depends on another person besides yourself. Mm-hmm. Children, when they walk out of your house, you're no longer with them. And so on and so forth. And it was a remarkable lesson for me. All the things I want out of life, I cannot will them.
Mm-hmm.
They're not under my control. Which is what control means. That you can, by an act of will, do this.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed obvious when you did it, but then I realized, no, I thought that if I didn't get these things, I was something wrong with me. You know, that's the problem. It's the source of most guilt.
Right.
Do you know that there were parents at Columbine, parents of children who were killed, who blamed themselves, who took on the guilt? There must have been something. I should have seen it coming. There must have been some signs in that school, and I didn't see it. Or the parents of the kids who did the shooting were obviously completely destroyed. They felt they failed. There were SWAT team members weeping because they didn't get in there sooner. They blamed themselves for the waste caution. Teachers blamed themselves.
Mm-hmm.
All of this, all stemming from the idea that I've got a power, a willpower, which is so great. The arrogance that leads to the guilt. People get laid off because the company downsized because their profits are gone and they can't afford to labor anymore, and they internalize it as a failure.
Mm-hmm.
You know? A doctor, a patient dies, maybe a new doctor. And the doctor did everything he knew, but the patient dies and he internalizes the failure on his part.
Yeah, I have a question for you. It's related to this and the control thing. How do you perceive, do you perceive a God? I mean, do you have a sense of a divinity that is somehow not, is in control while the human being isn't, or is it, how do you see that?
I don't see it, because to me that concept is an attempt to explain grace.
Okay, so it's a mystery.
The grace to me is that which occurs without explanation, without purpose or goal or direction. It's just a gift. It's a freely given gift. That's the wonder of it. That's why it is so, it grips us so deeply, because we know we didn't deserve it. We know we weren't looking for it, and there it is.
Mm-hmm.
Right after the heart of that thing, I got home. I was home well. And I was sitting in the living room, and my daughter was playing out the front lawn, Westwood View, where we live, with a girlfriend. They had ribbons they were running around, you know. And I think Carrie was maybe about 9 at that time. She had golden hair, you know, blonde. And it was overcast, and I'm just kind of looking at them like this, not thinking of anything. And the clouds broke momentarily, and the sunshine came down and hit my daughter on the head, the sunbeam, and just like a golden aura, just with her head thrown up. And I got filled with this enormous, deep sense of painful gratitude. You know, my God, it was almost like, how the hell did I ever be given such a thing? I mean, I never. You know, you feel like that old thing, oh, Lord, I am not worthy, thou comest in my house. You get that deep feeling of such deep gratitude and the immensity of it all. You know, it's very hard to describe those moments, but you never forget them.
Yeah.
There was a moment when I went back to that lodge where I got, well, it was on a Christmas Eve, we were visited, and at the end of the program that evening, they have this big hall, and there were about 200 people there, all recovering, recovered, with their wives and their kids. And I knew a lot of those families. They had been broken up in pieces and full of hate. And here they all are. And we all formed a big circle at the end. They turned the lights out. And we sang Silent Night, holding hands. And there was another one of those experiences of grandeur and mystery and majesty and the sheer grace of life itself. Not, you don't need a God to explain it. It just, you just receive it and hold on to it, and don't give it away to somebody to explain. Don't try to make sense of something that moves you that way, you know. And I live with those moments. Those moments they come to me. You know, I go to AA meetings and I'll get it. You know, somebody will say something, or I don't know. I'll suddenly depart from thinking about myself and just see myself connected to all these people. And then that expands to the thousands of others I've known over the years, all experiencing the same grace. I was at the lodge one time, and this young woman was there. My wife and I were up at the lodge. I don't know what it was for, but we were dealing with families. And she had come in on Saturday for a week. She was going to stay there. Her husband was a drunk. And she was getting it nowhere. She just got a deeper and deeper frown on her face this Saturday and Sunday, and getting all these lectures and this group discussions. And you know, the main thing with a family member is to get them to realize that they're dealing with a disease they can't control. You didn't cause it. Can't control it. You can't cure it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's tough news. She's struggling Monday and Tuesday, and we're all despairing, you know. And on Wednesday, it was sitting there in the afternoon, and she's at the table with that look, and there's a moment of silence, and we were looking away, and all of a sudden, what she had done, she slammed her hand down on the table, and we turned around and looked at her, and the frown was gone. She had this look, absolute joy and discovery, and she was saying, I didn't cause it. It's not my fault. And she was absolutely sincere. My God, she says, it's not my fault. The freedom, you know, she suddenly, something got it, broke through.
Mm-hmm.
And she saw her life for what it was. She didn't love the guy any less. you know. But now she knew, you know. She was free of that guilt, and she could begin to think like a normal person again. Yeah. It was, you don't always see it that dramatic, but it was, but I see that around me all the time. Mm-hmm. And I'm as much an agnostic as I ever was, because I keep, when people throw God at me, they're trying to convince me of something, and that's not what the name of the thing is. That's what we're trying to do. Why can't we just receive it? You know? Why can't we? It's there. The trouble is, if you look for God to explain it, you never see it. Most of the great moments in our life we destroy by explaining them. Mm-hmm. Nietzsche said that. In the search for everything, man understands nothing. We have this terrible drive to explain. It's in our brains. It's evolutionary. It's how we survive, to explain everything. Everything. But in explaining everything, we end up with nothing. Nothing left. Nothing left. Because even we become so driven to explain everything that we try to explain these moments of grace, and in doing it, we destroy the grace. It becomes, oh, that's nothing more than. And even with the minister up at the hospital the night I was doing this, he didn't affect me because I was in such a state of it. But he said, well, that's what they mean in the Bible by saying that the veil will be torn aside and you will see. And therefore, you know, No. You don't get it, baby. Yeah. It's got to happen to you to understand what I'm saying. Uh-huh. You know. And I talk freely at the church about this. You know, and at first they were worried, you know, my friends, because we were a Unitarian church, you know, you can't mention God, you know. And that's okay with me, because I talk about this without ever mentioning God. Uh-huh. And this is, I'm talking to you now.
Yeah.
I'm just filled with it. I know the wonder of life, you know. And it gets you in a frame of mind in a way in which you become very receptive to it after it happens a couple of times.
Like your eyes are open and you see it.
Yeah. Yeah, like the... I never cried until I got sober. I never felt deeply until I got sober. I never felt love until I got sober. I mean, all of that came with this thing, with this realization of grace. Mm-hmm. It all was part of the one package. You can open up, you talk freely about yourself, it's easier to love, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not afraid of dying. I had to, in 1987, 2 years of my heart attack, I was having trouble with the prostate, and the doctor kept giving me medication. I kept going back. I said, it hurts more. And finally the doctor said, God damn it. He said, I tell you, we only can cure prostatitis about 50% of the time. I said, God damn you, doc, it's getting worse. He said, all right, tomorrow I'll take a look. So the next day I went in there, and he puts a tube in, and I'm kind of tranquilized, but I can hear him. He says, oops. He says, there's a nodule, he said, on the neck of the, between the prostate and the bladder, there's a... I said, what do you think it is? He says, well, cancer. So, I said, oh, thanks for that, doc. And so the next day, I was in the hospital, he finished, and I was recuperating. He came in and he said, Joe, he said, we haven't gotten the full result, lab results, but I got a call from the lab. He said, it's a grade 4 cancer. He said, that's the most invasive kind of cancer there is. He said, it's really, really bad. But he said, I don't know how far it's gone, and that's critical. This was on a Friday. He said, so next Tuesday, I'll have a report. He said, you come down to the office, and we'll go over it and see what has to be done. So I lay there for a moment, and I was thinking, you know, I always wondered how it was going to come, you know. But you do think about that, the death sentence, you know. And I said, I won't know whether I'm dead until next Tuesday when I see the results of the thing. And I always thought when I got in that, I would never be able to sleep. I'd never be able to get through that easily. I'd, you know, live in fear. And the truth of the matter is, Donna, I just spent all those 4 days in AA. And I slept every night, fully. Mm-hmm. I never, in those 4 days, had a moment of terror or panic or... I have a prayer I learned. We use it in AA. It's a, You know, in AA, they say, when you pray, pray only that God's will be done. Don't pray for anything, say, which is very, very deep and important. And so the prayer I used all that weekend was, if it be your will that this cancer be easily removed, then thy will be done. But if it be your will that this cancer is through the bladder and into the surrounding tissue, and it cannot be stopped, then thy will be done. Both. You got to do both.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That's what the prayer is. Got to do both. And I slept, and I was okay. And then my wife and I went on Tuesday, and he said, you were lucky. He said, it's on the lining, just begun on the lining of the bladder. And he said, there's no evidence that it's gone into the muscle even. So he said, but it's a deadly cancer, and we have to remove it all. So they removed the bladder, the prostate, and even the urethra. The entire urethra was removed. And all the surrounding nodal tissue and everything else. And they found no cancer in anything except that one spot. Mm-hmm. But even with that, he said, this is so vicious a cancer. He said, we're going to have to check up on you every year for 5 years. CRIs, bone scans, everything.
That was in 1987?
Yeah, until 92. I never knew I was going to be free of cancer or not.
Yeah.
Then 82, all results were good. And then 82, he said, you don't have to do it anymore. You're over it. He'll explain. How do you explain all that? Yeah, I think the point is, don't try.
Yeah.
Just.
Oh.
Anyway.
Joe, I really, maybe this is a place to.
Yeah, okay.
Is there anything, but before we do though, is there any other?
There's a story I heard, just a story.
Okay.
And it's cute. If you believe in God, it's fine. If you don't, you know, treat it as a learning story. When you're born, God ties a string to you. Have you heard this story?
Uh-uh.
As you grow and you sin, you break the string. And God knots it. Mm-hmm. And each time you sin, you break the string and he knots it. But as he continues to knot it, he makes it shorter and shorter. And it brings you closer and closer to him. And little stories have a way of showing what you're trying to say better than words. That's exactly what seeing yourself and loving your vulnerabilities, loving your defects, because the knowledge of them brings you closer to the truth.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And that's the whole message. That's the whole message.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
Sorry, I take up so. Oh my God!
No. This is.